Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for April 14th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have, as promised, an in-depth review of the book Piracy by Adrian Johns. This is returning back to more deep consideration of the issues surrounding copyright. In this instance, Johns does a wonderful historical treatment of the very, very deep history of copyright itself, both in terms of the legal definitions, as well as kind of the behaviors. He gets into what he refers to, and I think these are good labels for these, proprieties and courtesies around this, alternate forms, kind of more normative, non-legal definitions of mechanisms for dealing with what it is that copyright law also tries to do in terms of kind of spurring cultural creation and scientific discovery and invention. I also have a new hacker word of the week, and some listener feedback to get to on a handful of the last couple of episodes. Before I get into any of that, I do feel not that I need to apologize for this being a day late, but maybe to help explain a little bit, just that the week got away from me in terms of time management, that I had meant to write this feature up on Sunday after doing the newscast, but I was feeling under the weather. And then Monday night, a family commitment took up more time than I was expecting and kept me from doing the writing that was necessary, and then a social engagement on Tuesday. This is not normal for me. I think the only other thing that is more normal for me that's starting to encroach a little bit on, I have invented a new word, encroach and infringe, but encroach on my time for producing the podcast on a regular basis has really been my brewing, and I think I made an ill-considered choice, something that I'll try to rectify in the scheduling going forward of making two beers back-to-back, two in such rapid succession, so hopefully that won't happen again for a while. I'm not on the hook to make any more beers for Balticon for Memorial Day weekend at the end of May. If we make one before then, it'll probably be on John's kit. If you don't know who John is, you can go back in the archives to the Hack Your Brew segment that I released last week, the wonderful discussion that we've already gotten some feedback on. Thank you for that. There will be a newscast this Sunday. I will do my darndest. I do have some social commitments, but I should still have enough time to get the writing done for that. I may, because I am behind in my writing, quite unrelated to anything else, I may take next Wednesday off just to have time to get caught up on some writing. I have a couple of deeper topics that just require more time to develop, and I think that that's going to work out best, is rather than rushing something out and putting out kind of a half-baked feature, it's just to take the time that I want to take to do these topics justice. The first bit of feedback is from Don, who posted a comment in response, as I hinted in the intro, to the Hack Your Brew segment that John Taylor Williams was so kind and generous to join me last week. And Don wrote, "Hack Your Brew made me very nostalgic. Back in the day, I homebrewed to the extent of grinding my own grain and growing my own hops. Life and family intervened, and as I gave my children the attention they deserved, I found myself unable to give my yeast the attention they deserved. Two things struck me about your comparison. Before you can make your own flavor of beer intentionally and consistently, you need to master your craft. If you, for example, you want to make Hacker Pilsner, you should be able to use your preferred ingredients and techniques to make a generic Pilsner. Mastery of technique opens the door to personal expression. I think the same holds true in programming. My sense is you believe the same. Also, for me, brewing became a lonely activity. The local home brewing club fell apart, and I had no nearby brew buddies. So I'll suggest extending your analogy to suggest that paired programming techniques, like extreme programming, should have their analogy in brewing. Often in brewing, a second perspective is useful. And as I'm sure you know, often it takes more than two hands and one strong back to move 10 gallons of boiling wort with the required care and precision. Not to mention the companionship of cracking open a couple of the last good brews and taking stock of life while you're waiting for the next good brew to reach the right state for the next brewing step. Keep up the good work, and thanks for your great podcasts. Thank you so much for your feedback, Don. Regarding mastery, yes, John and I generally agree. Never acquiring a deeper understanding limits your ability to achieve particular outcomes in brewing. I do not think that one needs to refrain from experimentation during that mastery phase entirely. The stock recipes and understanding all the techniques, especially considering the time investment in brewing. Playful experimentation can supplement faithful execution of set recipes. I've definitely found in my own case, varying things just a bit actually deepens my understanding of how various aspects of the craft work. I think that holds true for coding too, especially considering software can often be far more forgiving and easier to correct, certainly, than an off-batch beer. So while I do agree in spirit, I do think that there is room for a more blended or graduated approach. On your point about social dimension, I'd say that paired programming is certainly one way of many to make coding a little less of a drudgery. I spent a lot more time early on in the inner chapter segments in this podcast, in particular, delving into the various benefits of teams and healthy dynamics. There are the direct benefits, of course, of leveraging more minds and peer mentoring, but also the indirect benefits of reducing stress through team building and sharing non-coding pursuits as kind of breaks from hard lifting, like, of course, brewing, like we're talking about here. As for brewing with John, that social aspect is definitely why I originally stopped, similar to your experience all those years ago. And John has drawn me back in. He's largely responsible for getting me going again by his offer of not only help, but as you point out, exactly that mutual enjoyment of the craft, the attendant discussion when you're actually making the beer, and definitely the social sharing of the products of previous efforts. I'm very glad you enjoyed the podcast, Don, and thank you very much for your great feedback on the last feature. The next bit of feedback came in through email from Nicholas, who wrote, I thought you might be interested in learning about this app for Android, of which I was reminded during your last news show, in which you discussed mobile apps aimed at prohibiting some degree of social injustice, and he includes a link to OpenWatch and their apps page. I'll include that link in the show notes. This is an app that secretly records and uploads audio, video, and geolocation data, and is directed at activists who want to record evidence of police misconduct. Many thanks for your efforts putting together what is always an excellent show. Thank you for the praise, of course. Also, in this case, thank you for the link. OpenWatch definitely drives home the point that these are not just networked mobile computers, but also very capable multimedia devices. I do wish they had a bit more information about the security of this application. It uploads directly to their server, but it doesn't say much about how they secure it in transit, how they secure it on the device or on their servers, beyond the fact that they don't retain any identifying information for those uploads. One thing, the Guardian apps I spoke about, that's the suite of mobile apps that were in this past Sunday's news show, is that they definitely seem to have in common much clearer security characteristics. And that's probably, to be fair, informed by Nathan Friedis's background in IT security. So thank you for the additional link. Always glad to have more to consider. And if you're interested in this space of sort of mobile activist applications, then the app up at OpenWatch is definitely worth checking out. The final bit of feedback came in from Jody, who wrote, I would like to mention rock climbing as a physical pursuit that would appeal to hackers. This was in response, of course, to the feature I did some time ago on kind of the hacker mindset and exercise. The email goes on to say, I've been a regular gym indoor climber for about 10 years. Climbing is great exercise, but there is also a very engaging problem-solving aspect to the sport. With climbing, your own hands, feet, and body positions are the solution to a particular sequence. You are the process thread that must iterate over various steps to achieve the desired state. Looking forward to your next episode. Thanks for that feedback, Jody. I think that really that makes sense in terms of the kind of problem-solving aspect. That's an excellent parallel. In my new job, actually, several of my coworkers are climbers. They were talking about bouldering just the other day. So I will undoubtedly have opportunities as I start to socialize more with them to learn more about this particular pursuit. My only concern, really, because it has always struck me as more of an extreme pursuit, is how well you can keep up with such an activity as you age. I'm pushing 40 myself. How demanding is it is a question I have in terms of flexibility and stamina. And that's not just for Jody, anybody else who does rock climb. I'm curious. Although the fact that Jody's been doing it for 10 years suggests that I may have judged rock climbing incorrectly, that it need not only be a young person's pursuit. Thank you for that wonderful input. And also again to Don and to Nicholas, if you have a question, suggestion, or correction, anything really that's on your mind that you want to share in relation to anything I talk about on the podcast, as always, you can send that to feedback@thecommandline.net. The hacker word of the week comes from the Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. FLARP. Noun. Rutgers University. Yet another metasyntactic variable. See foo. Among those who use it, it is associated with a legend that any program not containing the word FLARP somewhere will not work. The legend is discreetly silent on the reliability of programs which do contain the magic word. Adrian John's book Piracy is an immensely ambitious tome. As a copyright nerd, I've heard or read many just-so stories about its history. An easy approach to a book on this topic would be to regurgitate that same fare that we already as enthusiasts circulate amongst ourselves. Even where Johns does discuss favorites, like the enacting of the Statute of Anne, the purported first copyright law, he fills in much more of the subtle and complex tapestry of the times and debates that served as a much more intricate backdrop to the law than is commonly discussed. In the instance of the Statute of Anne, he much more clearly reveals what exactly it was the Stationer's Company actually did, what role it fulfilled, and the arguments over mere formalisms versus a properly constituted law. In explaining the alternatives in that time, I enjoyed the parallels he drew through the Royal Society. This was a gathering whose formation he covers in some depth, but for which I have a fondness due to Neal Stephenson's use of many of its early members in the Baroque cycle. He goes into the formation of the society and its operation to explain how proprieties and courtesies worked in terms of establishing precedence and authority through registration and deposition of copies, often of monographs on scientific subjects, but also of devices and apparatus, so it has a bearing on patent and invention as well. The threads of argument from the earliest history of an intellectual property are teased out through these subsequent generations with very great care. The historical examples from the Enlightenment in particular reveal that piracy was far from just a pejorative label that the establishment foisted on its adversaries, trying to paint them in the worst light. So that's one of the parallels with today, actually. Access to knowledge, the distinctly modern coinage by public domain scholar James Boyle, is an incredibly apt description of the views espoused by printers during that time, and surfaces again in other forms in succeeding chapters in the book dealing with the advent of new technologies. The care and attention Johns pays in fleshing out the history makes this book immensely readable to those interested in the subject. I would also suggest that even if you're not as interested, but you're just a general history buff, that you might enjoy this as well. I did not find it to be dry or inscrutable in any regard, and it only took me some time to finish the book because of the size of the tome. With the full endnotes, it's 640 pages. And I definitely realized in the course of digging into this and consuming it from cover to cover, just how long and comprehensive it actually is. It's just a very well done treatment of the topic. The experience of actually reading it, though, as I hope I've been able to characterize, never really felt like a chore. It really was an enjoyable book for me. I was constantly making note of interesting ideas that he highlighted as he revealed this history. And for those that follow me on social networks, I even shared some of these minor epiphanies I had as I went along, as I found them to be compelling insights into a subject I really had largely come to, maybe unfairly, take for granted, that there's much more to just the historicity of copyright and patent and all of the developments around that. In touching on another pat story of the history of copyright, Johns reveals that the role of copyright in the American Revolution was more involved than usually presented. Most of the stories as we have them are of a pirate nation. I know I haven't read many accounts that really dig into the whys beyond just the founding of a new nation and that incredible thirst for knowledge. There was indeed some nation building, importation of skills and culture and other information, but that actually has its antecedents in the Grub Street hacks, the London reprinters that preceded that, that before the American Revolution were causing the London publishers such a heartburn, and then the Scottish reprinters as well, which was also, as Johns gets into, tied up in that country's push for self-rule. The chapters leading up to the American Revolution, in addition to discussing the battles over perpetual copyright, one of the first real arguments, developed the early pirate or reprinter rhetoric of helping to spread the Enlightenment by improving access to knowledge in the form of editions that were cheaper and often more portable. In terms of development, the early American nation didn't have the means yet for sustained journalism either, in addition to that need for patented knowledge and the skills to apply it. Importing broadsheets, newspapers of the day, filled in this early gap. There were also active curators picking and compiling news and information from Britain, not just doing a verbatim copy of material produced overseas. The practice of this particular aspect of the practice of reprinting in America, early America, made me think of link sharing today. It wasn't just the act of selecting and importation of information. There was a parallel in the development of public discourse. One of the participants, an English immigrant, Henry Carey, expressed concern over the lack of response to critical pieces that were published. It made me wonder whether a certain amount of inertia is inherent in such public dialogue, rather than the echo chambers and other lopsided exchanges being kind of accidents restricted to just, say, modern developments like online conversations. There was a coincident obsession with metrics in the form, in this case, of numbers of copies, editions, and circulation. This actually also put me in mind of bloggers obsessing over hits and social media users over followers. There was even a dimension of physical spread of information comparable to discussions around broadband penetration and access to the internet today. In the 18th century, this took the form over calls to build canals, and then that was succeeded by the same sorts of calls for railroads as early information networks, as well as the more obvious means of conveying physical goods. Other selections that Johns shares differ from the usual stories more significantly than just adding that additional texture and information. Instead of discussing piano rolls and Sousa, he shared the history of early sheet music just prior to that. As much as this episode is a bit of a surprise, the choice isn't arbitrary. There are compelling parallels to modern copyright piracy, a theme that recurs through the book, almost from the very first chapter. In this case, his discussion reminds me very much of the arguments over file sharing. Sheet music reprinters were serving a market of buyers too poor to buy at the higher rates the legitimate publishers wanted. This form of piracy was closely associated with activity in the home. The sanctity of the home is a theme that Johns expands on top of the simpler idea often discussed of the undiscoverable uses, like the youths singing the songs of the day on their front stoop, described in the historical setup in the introductory material in Lawrence Lessig's Free Culture. I had a bit of an epiphany reading Johns' account of the role of music at this time around the start of the last century. Music may be qualitatively different, I think, than other newer media. And by newer, I don't even mean things that we're dealing with today in a post-network, post-digital world. Sheet music is interesting because the demand for it was driven by home performance. There was a corollary rise in the sales of pianos as well that seems to bolster that. More so than books or film, music has a deeply ingrained participatory nature. That the conception of the home as a personal, inviolate space is bound up, at least in some forms of musical piracy, is not so surprising. I think that what confounds industry and lawmakers to this day over sharing music files is that while it principally occurs in the home, as modes of sharing did in the past, the internet is far more accessible than its predecessor, the press, and has the potential to expand the scope of music shared to the entire planet rather than just to an immediate neighborhood. The other example Johns illuminates that is a bit unexpected is radio piracy in Britain. You'd expect from the chapter title, even just from my setup of this story, that this would deal more with pirate broadcasting. There was a film with, I think it was Philip Seymour Hoffman a few years ago that dealt with pirate broadcasters. But it actually concerns an even earlier period where there was a struggle over the licensing of receivers, largely contingent on fears over interference, or what was then termed ether chaos. Johns uses this to introduce us to the earliest arguments around innovation tied up with all these other fights around intellectual monopoly, here embodied in the image of the individual inventor or tinkerer. And he actually revisits some of these discussions in later chapters as well in his discourses on the role of science that feeds into the current open access debates. A lot of the same arguments are playing out in modern media, like wireless and wired broadband, as we struggle with the effects of consolidation and the challenges in trying to leave room for new applications and ideas to foster innovation. And it's very interesting to hear almost the exact same wording used around trying to leave room for tinkerers to come up with things that were unanticipated by the large companies and trusts, RCA and the BBC at that time. One aspect discussed in the book of history, with which I was previously unfamiliar, and I've already hinted at this, were struggles for authenticity and authority. You can think of these concerns like the requirement for attribution in today's open licenses, and the moral quandary that has since arisen from back in the day of plagiarism versus the legal concept of infringement. The earliest example the author gives, pretty much from the start of the book, is the system of deposit that I mentioned with the Royal Society. The question of who discovered something or expressed some idea or work first are at the heart of non-legalistic solutions, so-called courtesies or proprieties. These notions also show up in copyright over and over in a couple of different forms. For example, some of the issues and questions we take for granted about the nature of creativity and the author's role were far from settled in previous centuries. Johns paints the arguments generation after generation rather vividly. The idea expression dichotomy, for one, originally was the reverse of what we think today. Arguments were made about mechanical copies, and here we're talking about copies of mechanisms, really, orreries and clocks, that the artisan interpreted the idea in the course of producing the copy, that it was not exact, and hence the copy was deserving of some protection as well, which is totally the opposite of the no independent invention in today's patent, that if somebody else independently invents an idea that's already patented, they're still liable. The idea that knowledge in a printed work trumped any moral rights of the author rose and was rejected more than once in the course of these debates, so even the nature of the printed work was far from settled. The fact that central tenets we take as just so today were previously so contentious should inspire a greater willingness to rethink intellectual monopoly in the face of such clear and dramatic upheavals in technologies such as digital copying and networks. Johns even points to moments of crisis in the history that he likens to the hard questions with which we are now faced. He finds that cause for optimism, that such junctures in the past have netted considerable rebalancing and adjustment for the better, for the public good. Actually, one of the themes he teases out is just the development of that very notion of the public good, of the public sphere. There certainly were large incumbents in many of these fights, just as powerful as today, and captive regulators often more than sympathetic to just maintaining the status quo, favoring those incumbents. I certainly hope he's right about this particular lesson from history, and in the meantime, this book serves well to offer specific instruction on how we might try to reframe the modern debate and hence move forward. As I've already touched on, one of the most striking themes of the book were the recurring modern parallels. Copyright, first and foremost, has always been about, well, money, fueling the conflict, originally between the interests of the book retailers, the printers, and eventually, but not at first, the authors as separate parties. These opportunities to seize control of creativity have always been so lucrative as to inspire the sort of invasive response with which we're faced today. As I said, I've already touched on some of the other more obvious and more palatable parallels woven throughout, in particular in how parties are viewed, described, and the framing of their actual discussions. What surprised me is that the Stationers' Company, for one, one of the first actors in the earliest arguments here, took for granted its ability to essentially invade the homes of suspected reprinters for the sake of preserving the propriety of their register of titles. The Stationers' Company was heavily involved with these earliest fights, as I said, over copyright. They wanted a perpetual right, whereas printers in particular, reprinters, were in favor of no copyright or at least a very limited form. And having the favor, essentially, having the advantage, they used that to exercise these search and seizure powers that cropped up again and again around the turn of the century in forms that would be very recognizable to a modern eye. The chapter on the piracy of sheet music that I've also already discussed for some of its other aspects focuses in particular very much on the pirate catchers and the lengths to which they went and the techniques that they employed in the pursuit of that vocation. A large part of the pirate radio listener chapter also dealt with the question of detection, explaining the checkered history of interference detection vans, which goes back farther than you might expect, and some of the later technologies that were developed for those same pursuits. If you read nothing else, though, in this book, the conclusion alone would be worth reading. John sums up all of these parallels that I've touched on and some more besides in a form that I think would make for a stunning online standalone essay. He pulls everything together under the rubric of kind of summarizing the past, present, and future of copyright. And as such, it's also worth reflecting at that point at the end of the book that the term piracy actually predates the usage of the term copyright and especially intellectual property. I'm not unsympathetic to listener Eric's feedback from a few weeks ago that you might remember that it is worth distinguishing between piracy that involves various physical brutalities and the kind that usually merely involves a violation of contrived rules over kind of intangible goods. If John's book proves little else, it is that copyright's history is defined as much, though, by those who question the idea of intellectual property for a variety of ends as it is by the development of the modern legal and ethical concepts with which we are familiar. As a consequence, that role of the pirate and piracy is so dyed in the wool, that's why I think it's worth standing with that term. It has as much significance, it should have as much significance to the modern listener, to the modern reader, as the other meaning for that term that Eric was concerned about, too much conflation, over-conflation of the two. The concluding chapter not only recaps the past, relating it to the present, but also offers, as I've hinted, some hope for the future. We've already seen some modern revival of historical responses to problems with intellectual monopoly. EFF, among others, has tried to advance the idea again of compulsory licensing as an alternative to ever more draconian enforcement measures and inherently unfair licensing terms. This idea predates even the legislative compromises with which we often discuss from American law, like the compulsory license terms that we have turned music deals into a bundle of sticks, as it's often described, or granted cable companies back when they were actually innovators of fair access to terrestrial broadcast. It actually dates back to some of the very first complaints against the British patent system that seems to have been overcomplicated pretty much from the very beginning. There were people who made a living by, even back then, 150, 200 years ago, maybe closer to 150 years ago, to shepherding people through that very torturous process. And it really prefigured the mess that we often assume is purely a modern phenomenon, something that we're working, at least here in the U.S., to try to reform, to streamline and make more balanced. John's history also serves to illustrate that we now call what, or to illustrate what we now call copyright's negative spaces, like the fashion industry and the design and performance of stage magic, are far from novel in how they deal with the real concerns over precedence and authority, as I discussed previously. This commonality through the couple of centuries' worth of evolution of the very idea of intellectual monopoly itself gives Johns reasons to hope that if we pay closer attention to what has come before, we'll find better ways to serve the public and encourage cultural creation. If you've read any of the more accessible, popular books on copyright, such as The Public Domain that I've mentioned by James Boyle or Free Culture by Lawrence Lessig, then piracy may well be worth your time if you didn't get enough of the history that shaped and informs this very complex and increasingly important aspect of modern society. That's just my impressions from reading this book. If it's been on your book list or it's one that you've actually had the time and opportunity to enjoy, as always, I'd be happy to hear your thoughts. If there are other aspects of it you found to be as interesting or more interesting than what I've discussed, as always, you can send those to me as feedback to feedback@thecommandline.net, where I'd be happy to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend, or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next episode should go in the feed Sunday night. If I'm crunched for time, it might not make it, but I'm going to do my best. If it doesn't go out Sunday, I'm probably going to take a miss on Wednesday, so maybe the next show will be next Sunday. At all events, whatever unfolds, until I talk to you next time, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.